Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. We are here once again for another episode of what we are dubbing Schwartzman's Summer. This is our second outing with our summer boy, Jason Schwartzman, and the film we'll be looking at this week. It's one of his villainous turns. Maybe his only villainous turn. If I've got that wrong, please don't hesitate to get in touch at CagedInPod and all the socials or CagedInPod@gmail.com. In Edgar Wright's 2010 Scott Pilgrim versus the World. This is episode 48 as well. Whoa. We're getting ever closer to 50. I don't think I'm going to do anything special for 50. I think I'm going to be deep in Schwartzman Summer for when episode 50 comes. But if you're new to this podcast, what we do here when we're not kind of basking in the glories of Jason Schwartzman, well, we're still going to be doing that anyway, is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? So over this 5-week period, we're using Jason Schwartzman as a case study. Does he alone help Coppola family become one of the greatest film families of all time? His output, does this film on its own help to state that case? And as ever, I'm joined by a guest, and we've got a return guest. First time on Coppola Connection to have somebody come back and have another shake at the stick to see if they agree with their old opinion whether the Coppolas were the greatest film family of all time. I won't say whether my guest, the one, the only, Matt Brothers, whether he said they were or they weren't from the last one. You can go listen to that. It's my chat about Edward with Matt. It's fantastic. And yeah, there's a few questions I say to Matt, hey, you get another go of answering this question, but they're the ones in the back end. Nothing up front. We kind of have a very Jason Schwartzman-centric chat up front, and it is a lot of fun. Both of us were kind of sweating our absolute faces off whilst having this chat, so I don't know, we probably don't get to everything that maybe we wanted to, but that's always the way. Me and Mac probably could have chatted for absolute hours, but instead you get this chat that you have right here, which is still plenty of fun and spoiler filled. Obviously we can't talk about all of the seven deadly exes in this film without spoiling something, especially considering that Jason Schwartzman's character Gideon Graves is the final deadly seven, the seventh deadly ex. So yeah, he's we spoil this film, and it's like a lot of fun nonetheless. Not that spoiling stuff doesn't make it can be fun. All I talk about, it's really hot now whilst I'm recording this. I think I'm losing my mind as I record it. So yeah, with all of that out of the way, I guess all that's left to do is to fend off some Seven Deadly X's as we make some Coppola connections. Welcome to week two of Schwartzman Summer. This week we're going to be bumbling about Toronto, getting to know the music scene, getting caught up in love triangles, and battling some Seven Deadly X's as we look at Edgar Wright's 2010 film adaptation, Brian Lee O'Malley's graphic novel series, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. The film is written by Edgar Wright and Michael Bacall and stars Michael Cera, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Ellen Wong, Kieran Culkin, Anna Kendrick, Chris Evans, Alison Brie, and today's Coppola connection, our very own summer boy, Jason Schwartzman. Joining me to battle the Coppola family once again and to see if they remain champs as the greatest film family of all time, or if his feelings have changed and he's looking for a new love, is Spock Lighter, Sudden Double Deeper, is Paul Dano O'Kea, and soon to be Greer leader, the busiest man in podcasting, Matt Brothers. How are you, Matt?
Hello, sir. Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be here. Sweltering. I mean, this really is Schwartzman summer. We are both feeling the heat right now.
Yeah. We're a couple of sweaty summer boys. We're
we're just sweaty summer boys.
We're juxtaposing it with talking about the chilly Toronto winter that is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So it's kind of a bit of a... I had lots of jealousy whilst watching this film, like kind of like being like, it looks so cold and lovely and I'm so hot and sweaty.
Yeah, Christ, ended to be back over there right now, my God.
So Matt, how have you been since we last spoke on the podcast? Obviously, yeah, I mentioned that there is a you were Paul Dano-ing when we last spoke, but
yeah, I mean, I looked, and was it this long ago when we chatted for Ed Wood? Was it about this time last year?
Possibly.
And I'm only going by that because of our Skype call history. Because
yes.
When I booted this thing up, I had a look, and I was like, it was not August. I swear it was like a few months ago. But I looked, and obviously there was two calls quite close together from our first attempt at Ed Wood, and then the second go-around. But yeah, since then, it would have been... the back end of season three of Is Paul Dano Okay would have been out, all of season four, which was where we're up to now. So we're currently have done all his stuff bar three or four little hanger-ons and his new projects yet to come out. So yes, what we're doing is taking a mini break from Paul to allow those new things to come out so we have enough for another big full season, and we're starting our, much like yourself, heading into Coppola connections within Caged In, we're branching out into the first of a few mini series we're hoping to do on different character actors in the same kind of zone as Paul Dano, with the first being the wonderful Judy Greer. So our fifth season of the show will be focused on her. We're going to look at eight new features that hopefully highlight some of the films that she has a really big part to play in, because she is notoriously the co-star, the best friend, the mum. Mm-hmm. We're trying to dig a little deeper and go beyond your Ant-Men and your Jurassic Worlds to try and find the ones where she really shines. So yeah, recording starts on that very soon.
Yeah, because I obviously, like, when you announced it, I did like a little, and I think I've covered Jurassic World on the podcast, and obviously covered adaptation on the podcast, which are the only two films I think she features in that have any kind of relation to the Coppola family. And her kind of appearance in adaptation is literally like a blink and you'll miss it, like waitress who gets weirded out by Charlie Kaufman.
It's hard to try and track down the films because she's got so many on her filmography that it's like, what some ones in here that sound good, and just looking at the ones you don't know, it's like, well, she might just be a one scene part in this and we'll be just left chatting about some weird film from the late 90s or whatever it is, being like, well, we did our Greer's chat within 3 minutes, now it's just the rest of it. So trying to go with ones where she's top billing, which is very rare, on the poster, which is also quite rare, And a few other main touchstones that a lot of people know anyway, or that I'm hoping to discover.
Nice. I like that you're taking that. Feels like a nicer approach than me, like kind of rolling the dice on films and going, yeah, I'll talk about, like, I recently discussed Big Eyes, which is also be released for Schwarzman Summer. And I had totally forgotten how little Jason Schwartzman is in that film.
Shit, like, he's in Big Eyes.
He has like two scenes.
Tim Burns.
He plays the he plays like a gallery owner who's very sniffy about Walter and Catherine Keane's work. Like, and yeah, he's got maybe like two scenes. He's kind of they've gone who plays kind of a lovable prick in films, and it's like, Jason's our guy, like they kind of called him in. So
that's it. I mean the dream is for someone like Judy Greer and even Paul Dano to have their 127 hours or lock or something where it's just them for the whole thing, to make up for all these years of bit parts.
And I guess there's that fear with Paul Dano as well, obviously, that he's directed a film, like, will he just get the bug of doing that and then announce, like, this is me, guys. I'm not going to be in movies anymore, like a
Jordan Peele type now, where he's like, I'm done with acting. Trying to audition for the poop and the emoji movie was a step too far. It's just my own movies now.
Amazing. Well, yeah, we were talking about small parts for actors, but what would have been the first film you would have seen Jason Schwartzman? Was it a small part or was it a big part?
Well, I think it technically would have been a small part, because thinking about it, I mean, Rushmore would have been the film, but I think I came to that, I mean, because that is his debut, isn't it? But I would have come to that maybe a little later, not a long time later, but I probably definitely would have seen him in Freaks and Geeks first, the one episode of that he's in from the year 2000, so a couple years after Rushmore. But that was definitely just a little guest spot in an episode of that. But I think I definitely saw Freaks and Geeks before I saw Rushmore, which is strange. So yeah, probably there.
Did he make an impact when you saw him? Were you like, who's that kind of, like, I don't know?
Yeah, he's very kid. Just Max Fishery, but a couple years older, and changed a lot in those 2 years. And it was even then, I think, you know, oh yeah, this guy's something. Because there's a few people in Freaks and Geeks who show up for like one scene. Mm-hmm. Some that you were already kind of like, Ben Foster is in, I think, the pilot, or at least one episode. And yeah, Schwartzman's another one.
Yeah, that is a fascinating show, because that's like kind of one of those nexus points for so many careers, right? It's like like Jason Segel, James Franco.
I mean, yeah, main cast, like, alone, my God.
Yeah. There's like all the, like, Seth Rogen, and then like you kind of figure out.
Yeah, Lizzie Kaplan's in it.
And then even like directors, like Paul Feig, I think, like directed a lot of that, or was kind of like the showrunner on that. So it's like,
yeah. Yes, his thing. Yeah, you've got Shia LaBeouf is in an early episode as well. David Krumholtz, Ben Stiller pops up, Rashida Jones. There's I love that show. It's fantastic.
Yes, yeah. Oh, maybe I'll have to cover it now. We'll cover that one episode that Schwartzman's in. He's there. That's because obviously his TV work, like, I was kind of thinking about this recently, that like, Cage might be the most prolific within credits, but like Schwartzman might pip him to having the most screen time in the whole of the Coppola family, because he's done like multiple seasons, or like, do you know what I mean? He's done a season of Fargo. He's done multiple seasons of Mozart in the Jungle. He did multiple seasons of Bored to Death and stuff like that. Have you checked out much of Jason Schwartzman's TV work at all?
Yeah, Bored to Death. Big fan of Bored to Death. I was watching that when it was airing back in the day. And just feels like a real odd one now, because it's one that I don't think enough people talk about. And that main trio of him, Zach Galifianakis, and Ted Danson. Obviously, Galifianakis went on to star in his FX show Baskets, which is really good. And Ted Danson went on to be in The Good Place as well. So it felt like that core trio, obviously, were already very well known, the three of them, before Bored to Death. And even since then, most of them have all gone on to have even more sort of TV success as well. But yeah, I really like that. And I think if I'm remembering rightly, it kind of ends on a cliffhanger, doesn't it, at the end of season three? Or at least something isn't resolved.
Yes, I think.
Without saying quite what that is. And it's like, fuck.
Yeah, I think it was cancelled, right? It was that. Mm-hmm. I remember it coming out at that time. You had that. And like, HBO seemed to have just like chucked a load of money at different creators to kind of like make these different shows. And there was How to Make It in America as well, that show that had Kid Cudi in it. And it's kind of about these young guys in the fashion industry. And I kind of remember being like really into them. And then like other ones kind of took off and like, and then others just kind of like, they went, nah, like, do you know what I mean? It's like, you can imagine there was a meeting. It's like, we're going to go over further with Bored to Death or Girls. And it's like, we're going with Girls. Like,
yeah. This being HBO as well for all these. Yeah.
And,
but it feels like, I think the show that maybe hits the tone of Bored to Death closest now is, Only Murders in the Building.
Yes.
Because again, you have like a core trio who are all movie stars. It's New York based. You know, it's sort of mystery focused. I think that's the successor. And I'd love to see Schwartzman pop up in that, actually. With Cage, do you think he's going to be someone who does any prestige TV at some point? Because when I think about Cage, he really hasn't done any TV at all, has he?
He's never, no. He signed on to do an adaptation, like a miniseries of an Owen Collier novel. So the guy who wrote Artemis Fowl. It's written like a kind of adult fantasy novel called High Fire. And Nicolas Cage will be playing a vodka-loving dragon who lives in the New Orleans bayou. And like, I've started listening to the book, and it's like quite fascinating. I haven't like got to the point yet where like the kind of plot is starting to unravel. Like the first few chapters, it's a lot of like character introduction and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That will be interesting. It's kind of dipping his toe at least, because it's a voice role, and I'm not sure if they'll be doing any. I don't know. They might be doing like motion capture with Cage. I'm not sure how the dragon will look. Or anything like that. If it's a big dragon, if it's a smaller dragon, I'm not sure. Like, but yeah, some of the stuff that he gets to do, like there's a monologue in the first chapter from the dragon talking about like how lonely he is, like how he got on Facebook for a while, and then Lord of the Rings fanatic started to get a bit suspicious, so he had to ditch Facebook, and how he's thought about having sex with an alligator. Because they might be the closest like relative to a dragon. So like, yeah, I could imagine. I'm excited to see Cage kind of get his teeth into a weird role like that. But as for like kind of Showtime HBO stuff, I don't think there's nothing on the docket yet. Obviously, came closer.
Yeah, no. Well, I kind of hope Cage returns. I don't think it's confirmed or anything in the Spider-Verse sequel, because of course we have Schwartzman as the villain for that.
Yes, there is. And to, off Schwartzman's TV work as well, there is a connection to Star Trek as well, in the fact that quite tangentially, in that Jonathan Ames follow-up series to Bored to Death, Blunt Talk, stars Patrick Stewart, and Jason Schwartzman is like a, I think, not sure, like a regular on the show, but at least has like a kind of multi episode appearances in the show.
Yeah.
Enough so that there's like GIFs of those two together. And I reached out to Liam recently and went, when we doing the crossover episode?
That's it. That's the spotlight on screen episode for Blunt Talk. Perfect.
Amazing. So obviously, let's talk a little bit about Rushmore. Like, obviously that would have been the first major thing you would have seen Schwartzman.
Mm.
What were your impressions of him as an actor when you saw him in that?
I think it's a real star-making turn. Like, it's one of those ones, like, you know, Wes Anderson has this entire catalogue of characters. He's someone quite like Tarantino who can just really create instantly iconic kind of characters. And I think a lot of people kind of compress and conflict, like, a lot of them together because his style is so consistent through all his work. But I think Max Fisher in that really does kind of stand out. And it's one of the greatest kind of like young debuts, because it's like, I guess you wouldn't call it a child performance at that point. He was like 17, 18 or something. but it's one that feels very much like it has this energy that he brings to all his later work in his later years that's there right from the word go. And outside of that, you know, I haven't seen much more of his earlier work until you get to stuff like Marie Antoinette and then The Darjeeling Limited, which is probably still my favorite Anderson film, I think, purely because of that central trio in that. And I think Schwartzman's a key part of that kind of trifecta of him, Owen Wilson, Adrian Brody, and they all bring so much heart to those brothers in that, like so much more than a lot of his other stuff, I think.
I think what's fascinating about that film is it feels like Wes Anderson's most personal film, but it's not his life that he's drawing upon so much. It seems to be, because it seems to be Roman Coppola. Like, because if you look at Adrian Brody's character in that, and like with the kind of the big sunglasses that belong to his dad, and then you kind of look at pictures of Francis Ford Coppola, like with the big glasses, and like the fact of three siblings, this feeling of that they have to match up to their father and stuff like that.
Because Schwartzman's co-writer on that as well, and I reckon he put a lot of himself into his character Jack there. So I think between the three of them, and Owen Wilson, there's so much of him in there, because you know he suffered from terrible depression. He had some suicide attempts, didn't he, in his life? And there's a lot of that baked into the character. So, yeah, you're right. I think it feels really personal. One of his most kind of real films, because it's so much reliant on... I mean, obviously, you have the train set, which they do a lot of kind of the classic Anderson kind of cross-section-y stuff with it, but not as much as like a Life Aquatic. But then all the location stuff in India is amazing, and I think, you know, I love his later work as well, by the time you get to Grand Budapest and French Dispatch, which I really loved. But that's pure like storybook, two-dimensional, in the planes of the dimension of what you're looking at, whereas Darjeeling really feels like the last one where it's like, yeah, these people are out there.
It's the prime example of a filmmaker, I think, kind of having a flop and having to like go back to some basics a bit, like kind of let's scale things down. And like you kind of wish it upon a lot of directors sometimes. You're like, oh, you've just been given these massive sandboxes to play in, and you've almost like lost yourself. Whereas like, yeah, where your Life Aquatic failed, like Wes Anderson was like, oh shit, like I haven't got that $10 million budget that I had on that, like I've got to go back to like a $4 million dollar budget or something.
I mean, he obviously had Fantastic Mr. Fox in between that and Moonrise Kingdom, but I remember Moonrise Kingdom feeling like his comeback in terms of a live action film. Mm-hmm. But there's only like 5 years between that and Darjeeling, but you've got 7 years between Grand Budapest and French Dispatch in terms of live action. You've got Isle of Dogs nestled in the middle there as well, but that felt much more like a bigger gap. And I kind of like, in a way, that French Dispatch got delayed so much because of COVID to 2021, because now it means, you know, he's shot two more films, basically. He's got Asteroid City and this Henry Sugar thing coming out. So we could be looking at, you know, two new live-action Wes Anderson films in the space of a year, perhaps. And that's pretty exciting as well.
It's absolutely insane, isn't it? I think the Coppola family and Nicolas Cage are going to keep me doing this podcast to my dying day.
You're not having to put pause on a season to wait for him to make more stuff, Dano.
No. I think you mentioned that online recently, and I was like, oh yeah, no, I think Nick Cage taking a little bit of a break. Maybe stuff won't be coming out till.
Oh no, wait.
yeah. Then looked at his docket for this year, and it's like, we're over halfway, and apparently we've got four movies coming out like for the rest of this year or something.
Yeah,
like that.
I don't know why the sort of clip that immediately popped in my head is Shaun of the Dead when they're looking at the letterbox. Just memeify that and be like, any Nick Cage films out there? No. Oh no, wait, there they are. It's like five.
It is classic, waiting for a bus and four comes at once in the Cage of a Nick Cage film. So what would have been the last Jason Schwartzman film you would have seen? We'll touch on it briefly.
Looking now, probably, well, French Dispatch in terms of what came out, but the Sparks Brothers as well. Like that's one I caught. I didn't catch that when it came out. So I think it's on Netflix now. So I think I only saw that 2 or 3 months ago. So that's probably the last. And he pops up in there, of course, that documentary.
I love that. I love that there's the reference, because Sparks have a song in Rad, the film that his dad produced and Tony Shire's in. And I think like he retells that story on like in the documentary. And I love that aspect to it. And like, I don't know, it did somewhat feel like that documentary is Edgar Wright going, what cool famous people do I know? Like, Jason, do you have any stories about Sparks? He's like, well, actually, and he's like, get in this sound studio. We need to record it. Come on. Let's go.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's barely in French Dispatch. I think he's got like a couple scenes. But yeah, I think one that we'll keep kind of returning to, and we did cover on Sun Double Deep, I think last Christmas, is Klaus, you know, his voice work in that. Because that made me think, I really do love his voice. And looking through his filmography now, it's only really Fantastic Mr. Fox, My Entire High School Sinking Into the Sea, which is very good, and Klaus, and now Sing 2. Like, sort of. Additional voices he's down as? Who knows? So mainly only them, but I'm so glad that Klaus is the one that has him up front and center as the lead, because it's just so gorgeous, that thing.
Yeah, he does a stellar job and gets to like draw upon, I don't know, it is like that thing that he's kind of been drawing upon the Max Fisher-isms of his career ever since. Do you know what I mean? He does play like these little pricks really well. And it's nice in that one that it's a little prick who has like a redemptive arc, like a film like Listen Up Philip, for instance. I really enjoy it, but it's like he starts off as a prick, continues to be a prick at the end. You know what? He's still a prick.
But yeah, you should resurrect Schwartzman Summer for one night only come Christmas for the Schwartzman Winter Klaus special.
Klaus has been covered. Klaus was our Christmas special last year. We're
oh shit.
Yeah, I'm not going to announce. It's boiling hot. I'm not announcing what's for this Christmas, but I've already got it lined up. So what would be your favourite Jason Schwartzman film before we get into talking about what to talk about?
You know what? I think it's probably a toss-up between, as mentioned, Darjeeling Limited and Fantastic Mr. Fox, because they're probably joint my top favourite Wes Andersons anyway, and he's in both of them. But then also, today's film, Scott Pilgrim, I think that's one, as we'll get into, that I've been obsessed with for ages. I always return to it, and I just think he's perfectly cast as that hipster douche Gideon. And even though Scott Pilgrim's very much an ensemble film, he's one that really stands out. Plus, great to see him in a out-and-out villain role with fight scenes, as it was to see people like Michael Cera doing the same thing.
Right, well, let's talk about Scott Pilgrim versus the World. But before we do, let's hear the trailer.
Hey, what's up?
I'll leave you alone forever now.
You know this one girl with hair like this?
Yes, that's Ramona Flowers.
She's out of your league.
You know her? Tell me now.
She just moved here. Got a job at Amazon.
I have to order something really cool.
Scott, are you waiting for the package you just ordered?
Maybe.
Scott Pilgrim?
Hi, I was thinking about asking you out, but then I realized how stupid that would be.
That's okay. You just need to sign for this, all right?
So do you want to go out sometime?
If I say yes, will you sign for your damn package?
So yeah, 8 o'clock? Come to this Battle of the Bands thing.
You have a band?
Yeah, we're terrible.
One, two, three, four! Mr. Pilgrim! I'm Ramona's first evil ex-boyfriend.
What?
Wait, we're fighting over Ramona?
Didn't you get my email explaining the situation?
I skimmed it.
Mm-mm.
What was that all about?
If we're gonna date, you may have to defeat my 7 evil exes.
So what you're saying is we are dating?
I guess.
Does that mean we can make out?
Sure.
Pilgrim! Prepare to feel the wrath of the League of Evil Exes.
Ramona dated twins.
At the same time?
If you want something bad, you have to fight for it. Step up your game, Scott.
Combo!
Break out the L word.
Lesbian?
The other L word.
Lesbians?
What are you doing?
Getting a life.
You want to fight me for her? Why on earth would you want to do that?
Because I'm in love with her.
Scott Pilgrim versus the world.
Maybe next time we don't date the girl with 11 evil ex-boyfriends.
7.
Oh, that's not that bad.
So, Matt, can you tell us what Scott Pilgrim versus the world is all about?
Yeah, well, this is the story of 22-year-old slacker Scott Pilgrim from Toronto, Canada, who is bassist in an sort of underground garage band called Sex Bob-omb. And he's in a bit of an early midlife crisis as he's dating a 17-year-old. And he kind of stumbles upon the girl of his dreams and finds himself tasked with defeating her 7 evil exes in Mortal Kombat. To win her heart. And it's based on a series of graphic novels, and it takes a lot of inspiration from the sort of indie scene of Toronto and video games and retro stuff. And yeah, it's a real amalgamation, and I think it's quite a tough sell, quite a tough adaptation. And I think the way it's come out is a testament to all the talent involved.
Yeah, because it's a film the budget for this was $60 million and the box office return was 49.3. So I'd imagine for Universal that probably wouldn't have been. If this was Warner Brothers in 2022, this would have been shelved. let me tell you that they would have been washing their hands. They would have they would have been tax write off for this film. What's your kind of relationship with it? Did you see it at the time? Were you kind of tell us a bit about you.
Yeah, I got really obsessed with this really quickly because it all coincided with when I first moved to London with an ex of mine and a couple of friends. And I think I just heard about it first with it being Edgar Wright's next film, having, you know, obsessively watched everything he'd done. And so I immediately started picking up the graphic novels, and it was really well timed in that, you know, the series of 6 books, the 6th book was coming out right before the release of the film. So the release of the final graphic novel, the movie, the soundtrack, the game, it all kind of coalesced in this summer of 2010 before it got trounced at the box office by The Expendables. but I remember reading through these graphic novels, and I think that's where my love really comes from, because I love the comics so much. The art style, the humor, the story it tells across those 6 books is great. And the more you kind of read it, you go, yes, Edgar Wright really is a perfect kind of person to adapt this, especially the kind of energy he brings from stuff like Spaced, especially this kind of early 20s up and coming group of friends living in a city, that kind of vibe, mixed with the hyperkinetic energy of like musicals. It's been called upon because there's all the performances of the band, so it's like a musical in the sense that we get to see this band perform songs throughout the film. But also in the sense of the way the fight scenes kind of break out, it's been often referred, you know, compared to the musical Logic of, you know, instead of bursting into song, they burst into fight. And then getting to see how each of these sort of titular X fights come about, because each one of the graphic novels is kind of focused on like an X per book. And so naturally the book series has more time to breathe. Like the actual story takes place over a couple of years, I think, or at least a few months, whereas the film is condensed way down. And I think it's a really unique case of, with adaptations, like most books get multiple films, or at least we see the thing of the final book in a series getting the 2 films split and all this. But I've never seen it where 6 books become 1 movie. And that feels like such a crunch. And it's a sub 2-hour film as well. And yet, I think that's where Wright's pacing and style and editing prowess and all this stuff come in to make it really work. And the way that they condense the main beats of the book into a workable film is really, really fascinating, because, you know, it's the basic bones are there. But then there's, if you know the graphic novels really well, there's so many tiny moments that are just moved around and happen out of context somewhere else. So there's so many bits. And I think it's because, you know, at the time, when they were writing the movie, the books were still being done as well. So at a certain point, they kind of started being developed at the same time. I think from book 4 onwards, there's kind of stuff in there where each one's feeding the other in a really interesting symbiotic relationship that you don't really get to see much. Like there's a line that's in the 4th book, which came from the writers of the film, which ends up in the film.
Amazing.
And then, yeah, all these little moments that kind of get shifted around. And it's only really with the 5th book and then the way the whole book series kind of ends does it kind of change a little bit to make it a bit more manageable for a modestly budget live action project.
Well, you're Brian Lee O'Malley, who like kind of unprecedentedly was involved with like most kind of comic book adaptations, like the creators kind of are well away from it. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of like, they either don't want to be involved or for whatever reason, it would probably be too expensive for them to be involved. But he was kind of involved with the way. And I was watching a making of like feature on it, and he was shown like the design for what Ramona would wear when they're at the Chaos Theater at the end. And he kind of said to the costume designer, "Oh, that's so Ramona. I'm going to use that in the graphic novel."
Yeah.
Like, when I get to that bit, and it's like amazing. And I love that kind of, yeah, that symbiotic relationship you talk about of how they kind of, I don't know, like they feed each other. And like, I think one of the things they'll talk about in the kind of design of this film as well is the way that they're trying to interpret Brian Lee O'Malley's interpretation of the real world, because a lot of like the kind of pizza, second cup coffee and stuff like that are all based on real locations, but then
yeah, Honest Ed's
adapted into his like kind of drawing style. So they're like, we're trying to capture those real places, but then at the same time, like heighten them to match like his. And it's like, we want Second Cup to look like Second Cup did when Brian first started writing the book, not how it looks now. And I think even down to the stories, like a lot of it, he said the characters, I think the you'll probably be able to correct me on this if I'm wrong, but the whole genesis of Scott Pilgrim came from the fact that Brian Lee O'Malley's, one of his ex-girlfriends had three guys in her past she had dated called Matt, and she just found it, he found it really funny, like and he's, that's where like the kind of idea of the evil exes came from. Of I think originally like it was the League of Matthews or something like that.
Yeah, well, just... I love the idea of taking something that's quite mundane and something that we can all relate to, like we all, especially when we're younger, maybe have, you know, various dalliances with people and they have baggage and history and there's exes involved. And it's like taking that very universal kind of idea and distilling it down into, you know, this video game logic. And that's what the graphic novels especially get really right, where the mundanity of just life as an early 20s something person, like whether it's trying to like get a fucking job and like adapt to being outside of like school and stuff, and going to gigs and just hanging out with your mates, like it gets the nuance of that really, really nicely. And then of course can flip on a dime to be obviously very comic booky and anime inspired and video game inspired when it comes to sort of the action. And I think that contrast is where so much of the humor comes from. Yeah, this film knows how to do it. And it's like, you know, I see so many comic book and graphic novel properties get picked up these days. I mean, it's great, it's hard to complain because it is a real golden age. Like right now there's The Boys on, there's Paper Girls, which I love, which I've just finished season one, which is really good, and Invincible, I think the animated Amazon show is probably the closest one-to-one comparison we have. But then there are others. I know I never saw the Why the Last Man series, but I know like Walking Dead and stuff, and Preacher especially, ones
Sweet
that kind
Tooth
of maybe
as well, is that one that's, or is that coming out, or is that,
oh, which one,
Sweet Tooth? Like that was a graphic
novel
series. Oh,
yeah. I think that came out as a film, maybe, like a Netflix film.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's one, but there's a lot of ones out there that kind of either just, oh, we have a perfectly good story on paper here, let's just do our own thing. Mm-hmm. And some of the time it's like, I get it, TV's a different medium, tell your own story. But this is one where it's you know, panel for panel recreations for so much of this, and there's so many Easter eggs packed in everywhere, but it still knows how to adapt its structure and change itself to be a sub 2-hour movie story versus a long running thing. And it's interesting because I guess you could have done this as a TV series, maybe not back in 2010, but maybe now you could see this happening as an animated show or even a live action thing, that you could do an Evil X per season delve a bit more into the nuances there. But I think, you know, the fact that this works for me at least as a film is a miracle.
And what I found fascinating is Edgar Wright's read on like the graphic novels was the whole thing feels like it's like Scott Pilgrim's daydreams. Like, I think he captures that. He brings that to the table. I haven't read the graphic novels, but like you get a sense from the film that that is like everything. Is the novel very much the graphic novels very much from Scott's perspective, like as much as it is in the film?
Very much so. There's a few of the supporting characters who get more characterization and arcs just on the basis of it being a 6-book series. Like there's a whole thing with Stephen Stills that goes on, and the idea that him and Scott and Ramona are actually dating. Like the film kind of makes it seem like if you want to start dating her, you have to beat all her exes. But in the books, they kind of do get together early on, and it's just them being together, and then every now and then another ex will pop up. So it's more of a kind of long-term thing. So, you know, you're dealing with like living situations and moving in together and work and when someone moves away and all this sort of stuff. And so you get a bit more of Scott's history as well with Kim and everybody. There's lots here, but I think the way Edgar Wright and Bacall here are able to distill a lot of the essence of these characters down, and a lot of that comes from pitch perfect casting and performance as well.
Yeah, so let's talk about the casting, because Edgar Wright kind of, he says it with much glee as well, like in the making of, where he's like, yeah, I cast Anna Kendrick before she signed on to do Twilight. I cast Aubrey Plaza before she got Parks and Rec. And
You got Brie Larson here, you got Captain Marvel, you got Chris Evans pre-Captain America.
Literally just before as well, right? This is like the last film he did before Captain America, which is insane.
Yeah, so we talked about this film quite recently on Sun Double Deep, actually, so I'm trying not to completely repeat anecdotes.
That's okay.
But I remember stopping by the Leicester Square premiere of Scott Pilgrim when it was on, like not going in and seeing it. I wasn't that important, but I was literally just in the area, so I got to see a lot of them, including Schwartzman on the red carpet, which I think was a blue carpet for this, if I remember. But I remember seeing Chris Evans up on the balcony part of the Empire Cinema, Leicester Square, looking out and kind of waving like the regal man he is. And that must have been August 2010, which I think was the same month I had my first job as an extra, which was on Captain America the First Avenger. So he was in the UK literally shooting Cap 1 when Scott Pilgrim had its London premiere. So that's how close together they were.
Amazing. So and I guess do you reckon, because the filming of this was a long shoot, right? This was, and from what I gather from the making of as well, that a lot of Chris Evans's stuff was done up front. Like I think the stuff with Lucas Lee, like that was the first fight scene that they filmed. So I imagine that would have been to somewhat accommodate, like, I don't know, him prepping for Captain America, perhaps. I'm not sure.
It had so many years in prep for this film anyway. So I think probably by the time they got to shooting, they must have known he was about to go off and do Cap. But that's part of the reason why, like, I was so intrigued by this film when I heard Edgar Wright was doing it before I knew what the hell it was, because I remember there was like the odd sort of behind the scenes photo coming out from it. And there's a photo I vividly remember of Edgar Wright with his stunt team, and he's got like a broken finger, or somebody has like at their hand in like a little finger sling and everything, kind of like beckoning at the camera. And I'm going, I thought this was like some sort of drama about like 20 somethings in Canada, like why is there a stunt team involved, like before I knew what the hell it was. And then it's just getting so intrigued seeing these behind the scenes videos of them doing like intensive like fight training for months, and I was just like, what the fuck is this film?
Because I think like this was around the time Edgar Wright committed to doing a video, like a photo blog for one year, and it kind of charts, like a lot of it charts the making of Scott Pilgrim. So like he got all of the cast and crew together on the first day, kind of whoever was about to take a photo, and he kind of says like, oh, I'm gonna take a photo at the end and see how tired everyone is, because he even said like partway through making the film, it's like, this might be my gray hair movie, like, this might be the one to break me. But like I find it fascinating, because for a film that, so I don't know, there's a lot of visual effects and stuff like that, but they rely a lot on practical as well wherever they can, right?
Yeah, I mean the visual look of this is amazing, and I think there's tons of really interesting behind the scenes post featurettes about this on the DVD and stuff of how they laid it all in. But it is yeah, really kind of interestingly subtle CG. Like, there's little touches here and there that I really love. Like, when he gets punched right in the face in the first fight with Matthew Patel, and the big word, I think it's like, you know, big pow or something comes up, and then he gets hit a second time and he falls back through the word, which kind of shatters into glass on the floor. Mm-hmm. Just really little amazingly intricate moments like that that kind of just embedded in. And then, like, you know, the aspect ratio shifts and the kapows and all the sound design, especially. Yeah, it's really something. And then, you know, the whole bass battle with Todd Ingram. Yeah, like everyone kind of has its own little thing. Because, yeah, what would you say? I think I asked this to Daryl on Sunday as well, you know, and to Jeanette. Like, what's your favorite Evil X fight out of the ones here?
Ah, my favorite. Oh, this was like the question I should be. This is the torturous question I normally ask guests. I don't know. I've got a lot of time for. I really like the Matthew yeah. Patel one, just because it's the first one we get, and like up until that point, like it is like an aspect of
yeah. That's like
what
an announcement.
Is this film? Yeah. And it's I don't know. They're all, and I like that. Obviously, it could be really easy for all of them to be quite samey, but like it's that fun video game thing, isn't it? Where you find like each boss has, like, whether it's like a Mario boss or whatever, it's like, oh, or all those ones where you had to find, like, Devil May Cry was really mm-hmm. good at it. You had to find the weak spot, and mm-hmm. that's like kind of what he does here, but it's in like real world terms, where it's like he uses Lucas Lee's ego against himself.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Can
the
you
back,
grind
the back
down
of
that?
Roxy's knee?
Yeah, or there's the whole like making Todd Ingram like break Vegan Edge by kind yeah. of like getting into his mind's eye and like really
milk and eggs, bitch.
Yeah, really thinking about the like the what he put half and half in and what he put soy milk in and stuff like that to throw him off. And I love those aspects of it, but I don't know. What about you? What's your favorite fight?
Yeah, I think the first one really does blow me away, because again, the trailers coming up to this relied quite heavily on clips from that first fight, and you know, the first block and the counter is like straight out of the comics, and the multi combo in the air. But that's kind of just the start of it. So when that happened immediately, and then we're in thick into the fighting, I was like, oh wow, this is actually going to do a bit more. And I remember thinking, like, surely they're not going to go as far as having him bring out his demon hipster chicks and do the song. And then that happened. And I was like, okay, great. they're doing the whole thing, because that was really not shown in any trailers. And I was like, wow, they're doing the whole like fireball attack and everything. This is perfect. This is, that one's just like panel for panel almost entirely. So that's great. I love the Todd one as well. The boss battle, bass battle. And again, that sort of thing, like the whole Chris Evans fight, like the fight against all the stuntmen is completely invented for the film. Because all it is in the book is essentially the grind rail. So I just thought, because again, that bit was in the trailer, the stuntman fight. So I thought, oh, they're probably just going to do something new here. So the fact that they did that and still did the grind rail death, I was like, great, they really are just hitting every note here. I think the only one that's kind of really different is the twins, who get a bit of a short stick here. But in a way that I really kind of like, because in the book they have this like little robot they bring out and they're kind of fighting all over the place. Whereas here it's basically just the Battle of the Bands fight. But I think that's a perfect way to do it and to get us into like the final fight.
I would be really interested to know, because I know that Oscar Wright, Edgar's brother, does a lot of like his like storyboarding and kind of character design. Do you know what I mean? Like a lot of his design work and stuff like that. And one of the things I noticed with those, like, you know, those creatures,
yeah,
kind of coming. You got the dragons, and then
such a great visualization of the literal Battle of the Bands, like fighting yeah. through music waves.
But you get those two dragons come out, and then you get that kind of gorilla that like is Sexper Bomb's like visualization of their angsty music. But then I did have a little dive that he also did like some of the design work for Attack the Block. And I was like,
oh yeah, I can see that.
Did, Did he just like kind of tweak that gorilla design
for
attack the block and be like, here you go, Joe. Like, it's, yeah, don't look at Edgar's movie. Like, just, and you saying about that, the invention of the fight with all the stuntmen, what's really like, what I found like quite funny about, like, one of the things is, Brian Lee O'Malley said that he was inspired because, like, by using that location of the castle, because he had seen like a film being shot there, which one of the producers on that film, I can't remember what the film is called off the top of my head, but Mark Platt was a producer on that film who happened to be a producer on Scott Pilgrim as well. So it's like the whole thing has come like back full circle in a weird way, that like the shooting of a film at that castle inspired that moment from that book, and then the film that's
yeah
like it kind of all kind of wraps around in a neat way.
It's all back there. It's so good. And yeah, that whole fight as well, that's some of the funniest stuff. I mean, Chris Evans in this, like, I love the guy. Like, we recently covered Sunshine on both Sun WB and Spotlight. And, you know, he's a real standout and a really packed cast there. And, you know, for everyone who just sees him as Cap, I think he's one of the main MCU actors whose work outside of it is just as impressive. Because, you know, you can see him be the douchebag ass, like in this, and then like the cocky guy, like in Fantastic Four or something. And then he's, you know, he's got his snow piercers and his sunshines. I think he's fantastic. And here, he really, from the second he shows up in that kind of trailer on TV for one of his shit films, you're just like, this fucking guy.
So, yeah, we got a bit derailed on the cast there, but let's kind of like rattle through. So Michael Cera in this, what are your kind of, like, obviously as somebody who'd read the book, like read the novel, the graphic novels, were you kind of like waiting with bated breath to see if he captured the essence of Scott Pilgrim in the movie?
Yeah, I thought he did really well. And I can see Edgar Wright had this quote about casting Sarah saying that, you know, he needed an actor that audiences would still follow even when the character's being a bit of an ass. And I think that's right, because this is a really hard character to kind of play, because he is this kind of like weedy, nerdy type character who has to be kind of almost illogically great at fighting as well. And I think if you go too far the other way, you might end up with a, speaking of Chris Evans again, sort of like his weak, small version of from the first Cap, someone of that sort of nature doing masses of kung fu. And here it's kind of believable in that heightened video gamey way. And he's just so good here at kind of being that cocky guy. And, you know, I know a lot of people kind of don't like this film because of his character, which I think is completely fair. But I think there's in no way that this film is ever not telling you that they think he's a twat, which he is. The whole film is about him kind of having to come to some realization. And the amount of times every other character surrounding him is constantly telling him he's being a prick is kind of a clue as well. And I think he is able to really embody that. And I think at the time, I remember that must have been quite interesting to see, because I would have primarily known him from Arrested Development, where, you know, he's not at all this confident kind of like ladies man.
Well, yeah, what's fascinating about that is that's what they saw, that went, oh, Michael Cera would be great, but, and like they were like, oh, he's too young. And then the film took so long to make, they're like, oh, he's aged into the role, like he'll be perfect for it now, like he's he's now old enough. And I think people had their concerns as well, like you're saying about him not looking the part to be like to do all of this like fighting stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, he looks like the type of guy who would be a bassist in a Canadian band.
Yes. Yeah,
and like if this was made today, like I don't know who his contemporary would be that you'd cast instead now, who could nail like the music side, the comedy timing, the fighting.
Well, I think he could still do it because he looks exactly the same pretty much, doesn't he? As much as he's kind of like tried to grow a mustache and stuff like that, he still looks like a kind of 22-year-old boy. Like, yeah, Michael Cera could still rock it as Scott Pilgrim.
I can see here that Edgar Wright said that Universal suggested Seth Rogen for the part because Knocked Up had just been a big hit. And it's like, I love Seth Rogen, but that's a different kind of thing.
No. Let him do the Green Hornet. Like, let him do that adaptation. One of the things I found with Kieran Culkin in this is, and especially like from watching him in Succession, is Kieran Culkin just playing Kieran Culkin and stuff? Because he kind of plays this snarky, like kind of wise ass so well in stuff. It's just like, even like watching him in the making of, like, I think he kind of closes it out by, they must have been doing talking heads with a green screen. He's like, so what are they going to put on this? And like pretends, he looks back and goes, oh yeah, that looks great. Like that is kind of the energy he brings to this film as Wallace, right?
Yeah, no, I love him. Like, you know, every time it cuts and he's been like texting while sleeping. It's like, Wallace, you gotta be bitch.
he's amazing. I guess we've really got to talk about Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who, for my money, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's Shannon Sossaman, like, kind of melded into Mary Elizabeth Winstead, right? It's kind of like,
yeah, very much nailed that era. Like, that 2004 version of Mary Elizabeth Winstead probably would have been a Shannon Sossaman type.
Exactly. Yeah, I always think, like, You could imagine if this came out, in the early 2000s, that would have been Shannon Sossaman, like, down to a T, right?
Just,
like, walked into that. I think for years I thought it was Shannon Sossaman for some reason. I was like, it must be. It's just so much of her energy.
Yeah, Winstead's great here. And, you know, Ramona's a really tough character because, you know, in many ways, like, deliberately, she is playing up that Manic Pixie Dream Girl trope. She's very much, you know, like almost literally like the prize to be won. It's a really hard character to kind of humanize. And I think if any, that she's maybe the one that gets a slight short shrift here, but is kind of brought to such vivid life because of the charisma of Winstead. And this is one where in the comics, you know, her character is allowed to kind of exist a bit more as a separate kind of person. Whereas here, because of the blistering kind of pace of everything as well, she's kind of dragged along with it. But, you know, I'm glad they kind of gave her some real standout moments as well. Like, you know, the fight of Roxy, that's probably another one of my favorites, actually, when she's puppeting Scott in terms of pure, like, choreography and, like, pulling out the massive hammer. And again, that's a case of them taking... So in the comics, she has a fight with knives in book two in a library, which is what they move to the pyramid stuff at the end, because Knives has that same long stripy scarf on of the dual Psy weapons. So that gets moved to there. In book three, Ramona has a fight with Envy Adams, which kind of becomes the hammer fight with Roxy in this. So again, they're moving stuff around and repurposing it all. But yeah, I think, you know, if anything's going to be the least believable thing in here in terms of stretching your suspension of disbelief, it's going to be the Michael Sarah Winstead pairing.
there's amazing like test footage of Mary Elizabeth Winstead where Edgar Wright's just like directing her of like from behind the camera, being like, look at the camera now, like the camera said something cute, and like, because she said like she just had to, from the comic she realized it's all about like the kind of eyes, like Ramona's got these massive eyes, and a lot of, because she's playing that cooler than cool girl, is a lot of like not saying a lot but trying to say stuff with your face, and she really captures that in that kind of first date they have when they're kind of like walking around in the snow and stuff.
Yeah,
like that. You kind of like get a lot of that, and I think, like you say, yeah, she does kind of get a short shrift and she is the prize for the film, but I think what she does with that character and kind of her facial expressions and her kind of mannerisms really like capture that, which I like. And I wanted to ask you about this. How do you think this kind of adds, or does it like kind of poke fun at the Manic Pixie Dream Girl kind of archetype? Like, what do you think, like the kind of, not the intention of the film, but how do you think the film plays to that?
Yeah, I don't know what the percentage of like weaponized Manic Pixie Dream Girl versus literally just using it as it is used kind of breaks down, really. So yeah, you know, the books give her so much more kind of space, and I think that's what it comes down to. The fact that this does feel like it takes place over the course of like 4 days or something is a bit kind of breakneck. But yeah, Wynn says great. And the moments she does have, kind of either by herself or just with Scott, really just give her something to do. And I think this is Winstead kind of coming out of the peak of her breakout as well, following like Death Proof and Die Hard 4 and everything. And yeah, you know, on a cast this stacked, I think she's wonderful.
So who else in the cast kind of stands out? Obviously, we'll get onto a certain spectacle villain shortly.
Aubrey Plaza's hilarious. Alison Pill, like these are just sort of the very background, like group of friends characters, which is weird to think of now with all these actors who are so great. Like Brandon Routh getting to sort of come back after his turn as Superman, because this has probably been the next thing I would have seen him in, and just be this amazing kind of himbo, dumb boy, vegan man, yes. having so much fun, and fantastic to see Mae Whitman as well as Roxy, with all her history of Michael Cera from Arrested Development. So yes, to see them kind of engage in this insane fight scene together, is wonderful.
I love Brie Larson in this, and the fact that she said she drew a lot of her inspiration from watching the Adult Movie Awards, like just to see how like the performers like kind of hold themselves, and she said that a lot of them had a lot like it just seemed like a lot of like vanity and ego, and she just brought that to the character of Natalie or Envy, like that kind of, I don't know, almost Valley Girl-ish like whatever mentality, but like I don't know, you said there's definitely like a vulnerability to her as well that I think Brie Larson really kind of
I mean, at the time, I was even though this was really early on in her career, I think I was pretty obsessed with her because of United States of Tara. Do you ever watch that?
No. So
this was her Showtime series. It's Toni Collette in the lead. It ran for 3 seasons, I think. And Toni Collette's someone with multiple personality disorder, which I think has different names now. That's kind of what it was billed as back then. And you know, so a real showcase for Collette, because she's essentially playing like 4 or 5 different alts of her central character, and Brie Larson's the daughter in it, so she's kind of there as like the supporting teenage daughter character, but it was a really good show and she's really great in it, so I think that was just before or around this, so I knew she was great. And then yeah, I didn't realize she had like a musical career beforehand, but she gets to shine in that sense here with her Black Sheep performance, and I love Metric and all the music in this film as well, and I've seen Metric live a whole bunch of times now, and every time they, I think maybe twice at the times I've seen them, they've opened with the Black Sheep song from this, and it does just amazing. Immediately make you feel like you're in the movie. It's like, yeah, oh no.
Yeah, they had some really like a lot of praise for this film, and the fact that the thing that they loved about it was that they recreated Lee's Palace in how it used to look, like from when they used to kind of, they talk about like sneaking into it through the back door and stuff like that, and they're like, we love that Edgar like just recreated how Lee's Palace used to look like back in the day, because I think I don't know if they were like on set for it or kind of got to like kind of probably be a part of the crowd for that show or whatever, like I imagine probably if yeah that they probably I think Broken Social Scene as well. Am I right in believing that the Sex Bob-omb music is written by Beck as well?
So Beck kind of created all the Sex Bob-omb stuff, and it's great. Like, I really love all the songs that feature in it, and I think for ages there are some other tracks that you couldn't get on the initial soundtrack release, but you could hear in the background every now and then. It's a track called No Fun. It's not on the soundtrack. You can hear it for a few seconds somewhere, and I think it wasn't until the 10th anniversary re-release of the soundtrack, like deluxe one, where they finally released all the other Sex Bob-omb songs. But yeah, that was all Beck, I think.
Amazing. So anyone else on the cast that we've missed that you wanted to mention before we get to the big man himself?
I mean, it's one of those casts where pretty much everyone in it you can mention, which is fantastic. There's the guy, I'm trying to remember his name. He's in a whole bunch of New Girl as well. He's very funny. He's the guy who's at the party who knows everyone.
Yeah, and he gets those great bits as well at the Chaos Theatre, like
yeah.
Both times when Scott comes in, he kind of has like a really hipster line. He's like, oh, the first album's better than the first album. Like,
Nelson Franklin, playing Komu. He's He's very funny in New Girl as well. But yeah, he can just be someone, you know, when Scott just holds up that clearly very badly drawn drawing of Ramona that's riffing on the comic star and be like, no girl looks like this. And the guy immediately is just like, yes, that's Ramona Flowers.
Yes. What about Ellen Wong as Knives Chow? What do you
think? Oh, she's amazing. Wong's? Yeah. I was thinking what else I'd seen her in recently, because it felt like I have everybody who did and didn't break out after this. She's someone who sort of didn't, but should have a lot more. Yeah, it's this horror film called The Void from 2016. I rewatched recently. She's in that. She's very good in that. And Glow, of course. Love her in Glow.
Yes. Well, let's talk about Jason Schwartzman, who plays our big bad, our seventh and final.
G-Man is Gideon.
what do we think of our out and out villainous role for Jason Schwartzman here, Matt?
It's great. He's perfectly teased as well. Like, you know, you get all these. I mean, that's something Edgar Wright does amazing anyway, just layering in all these sort of clues to something. And in this, it's the recurring theme of X's and seven and numbers and symbols and all sorts. And then, the G-Man tease and everything. And, you know, by the time we finally realize who he is when he's watching the Battle of the Bands, it's just like, oh, and then his kind of intro scene by his car as that perfectly kind of, like you say, like a New York hipster guy of just chatting away, chewing gum, acting all the hot shit, and just being a complete prick. And then especially down to his phone call with Scott from the Chaos Theater, prompting Wallace to be like, you know, I take it back. Go finish this guy. What a perfect asshole.
and there's that little moment. I kind of think, like, I only caught it on like a recent rewatch. That was kind of from what, like, reading like a lot of the trivia about this film is. When you see him at the crowd at the Battle of the Bands, he puts his hand up at one point to Ramona's face, and the ring like glistens green and like makes, I think it's like a sound from like Zelda or something like that. Because I know that they
a lot of Zelda sounds here.
Yeah, I know that Edgar Wright, and I love this little fact as well, that he wrote a letter to Nintendo to use those sounds and said, like, his kind of key line was that they are like the
childhood memories, right? Oh, nursery rhymes.
Like,
yeah,
they're like nursery rhymes for this generation. It's kind of like, you slick motherfucker. Do you know what I mean? That's the kind of line that gets you stuff, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, the film opens with like the music jingle from I think the beginning of A Link to the Past, and then you've got the fairy fountain theme in his dream. Just the little da 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 da, like discovery noise, and you've got a sonic ring effect from, I think it's when, I can't remember who, just raises their eyebrows real quickly. Yeah, so many great little retro video game sounds nestled in, and yeah, Zelda ones are all over the place.
Yeah,
which for a big Zelda guy like me is very nerdy. I love it.
So, yeah, with Jason Schwartzman as the villain, what do you think of the kind of like him as imposing? Like, does he seem like a threat in this film? Like, would you like, do you know what I mean? If you're in Scott's position, like,
it's interesting because he kind of is at first, and then they very deliberately kind of undercut him quite a lot, you know, when he's going like, you know how long it took for me to put this lead together? Like 2 hours. And he's just complaining about swallowing his gum and just being like really petty. So they set him up as this real powerful kind of record deal club owner. And then you realize a lot of it's just kind of a show, and he's just a bit of a baby as well. And I think that's something Schwartzman can really do, where he can be somebody with that kind of authority in that world. And he's very believable at it. And at the same time, you could probably chop him down to size quite quickly as well. But even then, you know, by the time he's pulling out his digital katana, it's like, yeah, this guy is on. And he's actually, when you think about it, sort of a perfect match for someone like Michael Cera to have a fight to the death with.
And I like the fact that, like, I think it is through the casting of him, and it is that thing of, I don't know, like the story of this film of, you always, like, especially when you're young, you make your girlfriend's ex out to be something, like whether they are like the hardest man in the world or the most intimidating man in the world, however that may form. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, they're going to be better than me, this, that, and the other. And yeah, the way they do that undercut with, like, yeah, like the line where it's like, you made me swallow my chewing gum. That's going to be in my stomach tract for 7 years. Like, it is that he plays this kind of massive man baby.
Yeah. But there's so many well. There's so many amazing bits from that. And there was a shot, I think I first saw it, I think it was in not even one of the first trailers, like one of the first TV spots. Like, I was literally devouring every bit of marketing I could for this. And there was a shot that they put, I think there was a special TV spot that Edgar Wright put out, which is scored very specifically by a certain remix guy. And it's got that shot where I think it's after he's knocked Scott to the ground for the first time. And there's this slow-mo shot of Gideon sort of whipping back up and his hair flings back. And the lighting of like the lightsaber-like blade in his glasses is there. And he's chewing his gum and Ramona walks down beside him. So it's just amazingly well put together moment of just like, oh, damn, he's cool.
And yeah, what are the things I saw as well? It's like, I think wearing the glasses caused him a bit of trouble because during the bloopers, there's a lot of like him just losing his glasses, like during the fight scenes. And him and Michael Cera as well both mentioned the fact that they didn't realize, like, kind of you see all this fast paced action on screen, that how long that stuff like actually takes to film. Do you know what I mean? They're like, oh, you see it, yeah, you see it in movies, and like, oh, I bet that took them like a day, and it's like, oh no, that fight sequence at the end took them like weeks to film, like, which is insane, right?
Yeah, and I mean, this is it. If they, I mean, I love that whole final end fight, and if they had kept to the book, you know, the book goes like cosmically insane, like, you know, there's a lot more subspace stuff, and Gideon becomes this like Giga Gideon, like God beast thing, which I can see being like, yeah, maybe we don't turn lovable Jason Schwartzman into this like CGI Hulk monster thing. But seeing how they did the gorilla and the dragons, maybe they could have pulled it off. But yeah, it kind of allows in this instance for the book to go completely in one direction of scale and ambition, and for the movie to kind of stick its landing its own way.
So do you think on that regard that like, and especially with the fights we've seen beforehand, is this last one satisfying, and is it kind of the, or is it more of like a whimper to you? Like,
I love it. I love the unique setting of the Chaos Theater with the pyramid. I love the kind of the do-over. You know, we get to see Scott take out all the goons first, and then the first fight where he loses and then kind of gets brought back to life and goes through it again, and it kind of all speeds up, and then we get, you know, sort of a round two to it all, and then Knives showing up and everybody adding in. Like, it's a great kind of combination. I think I'm just a real sucker for a really good kind of sword fight. And when it's, you know, a flaming sword that someone pulled out of their chest versus like a digital katana, it's like, yeah, that's a cool pair. And you can tell Schwartzman really did his training. He has that, especially early on, has that really sort of relaxed fighting style where he's kind of like, he's got one hand behind his back and he's just doing all these blocks and things. And then, yeah, by the time he's getting his head kicked in, it's it's gone the other way.
Yeah, there's another amazing outtake of this where, like, see within the fight, like, all of a sudden Jason Schwartz are like, oh, my pants have just ripped. Because obviously, like, he's doing all this fighting, but he's still dressed like a hipster doofus in, like, do you know what I mean? In, like, tight trousers and, like, the blazer and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's really got me interested to see the comparisons now between the books. Like, I would have read them before, but
yeah, hey, like, I highly recommend.
I got enough time, I'm a bit busy guy.
Yeah, you can do all six in like one setting, because, you know, they are like little snippets, little chunks. And again, you start noticing, especially if you know the film very well, you'll start noticing little bits everywhere. So in the fourth book, the fight with Roxy involves basically the sword fight we get at the end here with Gideon instead. So there's a moment where they both jump up and slash at each other in the air, or I think he's actually fighting her dad, who turns up, and there's a bit where he kind of lands on like one knee and cockily goes like, everything okay back there? And that exact moment is in the Gideon fight after he does the slash the second time. So it's like, oh, that's from that bit there. But yeah, for the kind of full flavor. And I think that's what's great about this IP, if you will. Like, it's weird to talk about it as an IP or even a franchise, because the entire franchise stuff all came out at once. So it's like between this, the books, definitely the soundtracks, and the video game as well, which kind of is the almost final form of something like this, to actually put it in the style format that it's riffing on so much, and the game does it so well as well. Because that's kind of the perfect thing, where it's kind of the game of the film, but it can now literally use the art style from the books, and also the little animation as well. It's like an animated sort of side short film as well. So you get, you know, if you do all of that, you get the whole spectrum.
Amazing. What one of the things I love about that final fight as well is the kind of, we get the closure to the knives, like, kind of plot line as well. And we get a nice callback to them playing that kind of ninja dance game that they seem to play when they go on their, like, their dates, whether it's like, yeah, Scott really getting involved in like the first one, or like getting decapitated in the second one. But yeah, when it kind of goes into that, and like, I remember watch it again, it's like, oh yeah, they're doing that, and it's like, you get the voiceover, right, it's like, combo, like, and stuff like that. It's
seeing
so
Schwartzman's
fun.
Face getting like punched like 20 million times.
Yeah,
in like freeze frame style as well.
I can only imagine, I think, like, some of the crew touched on this, is that, like, Edgar Wright had this film kind of edited in his head, and like, he kind of knew exactly how everything was going to look from get-go, because I can only imagine, like, to kind of visually, yeah, or to physically do all of this and get this all, or even just to like think about it and be like, yeah, this is how it's gonna look, like, makes my mind melt. Do you know what I mean? Like, so to have that all in your head, it's like, hats off to Edgar Wright. Like, he's really, I don't know, I think it's a real shame that this film kind of, it's obviously gained a reputation, but like at the time just didn't get its,
well, yeah, you know, for this sort of film to be coming from a major studio as well, like, I think now it'd be very hard to get something like this that's so kind of unique. I guess maybe something like Ever All at Once is maybe the closest kind of comparison in terms of unique style and ambition coming from a sort of studio, but even that, you know, that's not as big as Universal, so I think it would have to be more of an indie thing if this was done today. Hopefully not in part, you know, because of the financial failure of this, really. And yeah, definitely did pick up kind of cult status, but it's been a sort of slow road, I think.
Are the Daniels, like the predecessor, the almost like the torch carriers from Edgar Wright, if we can say that?
I think so. I know Edgar Wright loves them. I remember he was moderating like a Q&A with them recently, and hanging out with them in London when they were over here. So they're obviously pals. Obviously sees a kind of kindred spirit there. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see kind of what more they do. But they're someone who very much feels like they have a style in the filmmaking, in the visuals, but also like the thematics and the kind of stories they tell and the way they tell them, and the blending of the surreal and the really profound. That can be seen across both their films and their short work as well. Whereas Edgar Wright now, I don't know, I feel like Edgar Wright's kind of, maybe the Daniels are kind of picking up the old school Edgar Wright torch, because Edgar Wright now, between like Baby Driver and Last Night in Soho, still very stylistic, but you wouldn't say in the same way, like you couldn't, if you were a fan of Space and you watched Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, you'd be like, yeah, that's the same guy. But if you then watched Last Night in Soho, you might be like, oh, well, this is someone doing something a bit different, which is interesting. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see what he does next, and what kind of area of film or genre he kind of turns his hand to next, and whether a bit of the old Wright kind of comes out in it again, or whether he's very much like, no, I'm trying to do something different now.
Yeah. Is he going to do that thing where a band go like, oh, what we've been doing all these years, like diverting from that style that made you love us. Well, we're going to come back and do an album that sounds just like that first album.
Yeah, I do think if he does do another film with Peg and Frost, then it'll come back. Yes. So it's whether to be seen whether that happens. I think they'll do something together at some point again.
And to that point on the Daniels, well, I think like this film is like a perfect companion piece to what they do, in that they seem like filmmakers who are very much kind of, everything is an influence, whether it is video games, YouTube, like kind of like pop culture in general. All of it is kind of, that's the thing I loved about Everything Everywhere All at Once, is the fact that it's There's no low art. There's no high art. There just is. There's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It is all valid and it's all beautiful in its own way. And it's kind of, that's what Scott Pilgrim does in a way. Do you know what I mean? It has beautiful moments in it, but then we'll do like crash jokes. It will kind of do anything to kind of dazzle you and like excite you, and not in that kind of saccharine or, I don't know, designed by committee way where it's like, how are we going to get the most eyes on this? It is kind of this thing of like, let's capture the frantic and frenetic energy of this comic book, like in the best way we can. I think it's really great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing more Brian Lee O'Malley adaptations as well, because I've read his other books. Lost at Sea is really nice. And Seconds, which was the first thing he did after the Scott Pilgrim series finished, which I believe is being done as a film now. Blake Lively's directing, and yeah. Edgar Wright is writing the script, so it's all staying in the family.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. So any closing thoughts on Scott Pilgrim vs. the World before we start to wrap this up, Matt?
No, I mean, it's still a favorite of mine. It's like, it's strange. I come back to it every so often, or in this case, a couple of times in quite quick succession. And, yeah, there's always parts of it that I spot that I've missed before, bits that I can just recite at the back of my hand, and like, especially all the music as well. Yeah, I think it's a really unique ensemble kung fu fighting video game musical slacker drama, and there's been, and I'm kind of glad there wasn't many imitators, or at least people trying to recapture this kind of magic, because it could have gone any number of ways, like people leaning too far into video game style fight scenes in otherwise grounded sort of comedy dramas, or just straight up kind of ripping off Wright's style when it comes to sort of directing actors and ensembles. And like, I guess in that case, because it'd be annoying if there'd been a whole slew of imitators after this kind of flopped and then they did a whole lot better. So it's kind of acts, it kind of exists in its own bubble still. Yeah, I look forward to the next rewatch, whenever that shall be.
it is kind of perfect and kind of poetic, but it kind of, the film lives in almost this underground band thing where it was like, well, it wasn't appreciated at its time and has kind of since like gained popularity. And like you said, it wasn't like people jumped on the bandwagon and like, I don't know, imitated, like, yeah, we'll use that band analogy, like, oh, you all of a sudden get 1,000 bands who sound like that, and then it's like, oh, why is that band really popular over like the guys who originated this sound, like, etc. Whereas like this, like, I don't know, it's like, will we ever get another Scott Pilgrim, like, again? And it's nice. It's like a unique gem, an uncut gem, if you will. So as we wrap this up, Matt, I'll ask you, did you manage to find any Coppola connections within this film? Has anyone who worked in front or behind the camera worked with the Coppolas elsewhere?
Oh, God, no, I didn't think of this. You'd think there's something out of the amount of people in here, but scanning through who else is there, I mean, it's tough to, because the cast is also uniformly young. Like, I think outside of Brandon Routh, Chris Evans, and Jason Schwartzman, and then, of course, the Thomas Jane cameo as well, and what's his face with him? What's his face? The other vegan police guy.
Oh, what is...
Clifton Collins Jr. Outside of those guys, it's pretty much a uniformly under 25 years old cast, it feels like. So no one's really going to be old enough to have starred in any Francis stuff. Don't think any of them's really done anything, even with Cage, when you look at it.
No, so I can throw you a few. You got one? So Michael Cera is in Crypto Zoo, which is the same director who did My High School Is Sinking Into the Sea.
Uh-huh.
So his newest film. And is in A Very Murray Christmas, which Sofia Coppola directed. Anna Kendrick is in the Mark Peace Experiment with Jason Schwartzman. And A Simple Favor, which John Schwartzman was the director of photography.
Uh-huh.
Directed by aforementioned Paul Feig, who seems to have worked with the Coppolas quite a lot. I think directed a few episodes of Bored to Death as well, if I remember correctly. Aubrey Plaza is in Funny People and sleeps with Jason Schwartzman in that film, as he plays the arsehole kind of roommate to Seth Rogen's character. And she's also in A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III, which is the second directorial work from Roman Coppola.
Uh-huh.
And Brie Larson is in Between Two Ferns, the movie, as so is Jason Schwartzman, which I imagine he did as a favour for his old pal Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, I'll be in your movie. Let's, like, be really mean to me, as you are to everyone on Between Two Ferns. So yeah, they're the Coppola connections we've got for this episode. So let's rate the film, Matt. So what would be the how we do that here, just in case you're a first time listener and you've got this far into the episode, is what would be the perfect wine pairing? What are we drinking with this film? What kind of wine are we drinking?
Oh God, I don't know if wine goes with this one. It would have to be shots or something in the back of some dive bar while a support act band is playing up front, or some very, I tell you, like a can of Red Stripe beer whilst waiting at a gig venue for sure. just a bucket full of that.
you've paid £5 for a can.
Yes,
you're grateful for it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
and you found an American Red cup to pour it in, like at the house party as well.
Amazing. That would be a perfect pairing, or two gin and tonics.
Yes, well, it has to be some kind of pretentious wine that they'd serve at the Chaos Theatre. Something that fits in there, that would be served on a tray that he knocks out of that guy's hand.
I like that. Yeah. Or a Coke Zero, which is is that Scott's drink of choice? I think Gideon calls him out for it. So how much are we paying for this Red Stripe? Obviously we've joked that it would be £5 at a bar, but is this let's take it to the supermarket. Is this bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf booze for this?
Well, I think the beer is bottom shelf, but the movie is top shelf.
Perfect. We're going on the budget of Scott Pilgrim, but yeah, the movie is top. I think this is, I have to agree with you on that. Like, I sometimes stay a little bit agnostic with giving my opinions, but I'm trying to get better at kind of saying what I would think of this as well.
It's all you'd be able to afford from the returns of the box office.
I definitely think this is a top shelf film. Like, it's massively rewatchable, right? It's kind of like, I don't know, like, I think I heard you guys talk about it on Sudden Double Deep and was like, I really want to watch that again. And then, like, I was putting together Schwartzman somewhere. I was like, I kind of really want to watch Scott Pilgrim versus the World again. Should I ask Matt if he wants to do that film?
That's going on. That's it. And, you know, how many other films is Schwartzman out as outright a villain as this? You know, you could say, you know, even Max Fisher's like another little prick kind of guy, but in terms of like big bad, like, he's not going to be the main baddie in like in a Mission Impossible series or something, as much as I would like to see that, actually, as the kind of mastermind ordering the goons around.
We're still yet to find out the full cast from Dead Reckoning Part 2. They've got Nick Offerman in there. Stranger things could happen. But we're going to see Jason Schwartzman at least voice the villain
in
Across the Spider-Verse. So that is that. I look forward to seeing him flex his villain muscle once again in that. So I'll tell you what you answered last time based on Ed Wood, but based on Scott Pilgrim versus the World, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
Yeah.
Perfect. You answered yes last time.
If I said no now, it's like, which is it, man? Which is it?
We're two for two. No. It's based on this film alone. So I'll ask you this one again and see if your answer has changed since this time last year. Which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire rest of the family's filmography?
Well, I remember I did say Jason Schwartzman last time, didn't I? I think because of my affinity for him, and I think I'm going to keep the same answer. And in the spirit of Schwartzman Summer, I've just remembered that me and him actually share a birthday. June 26th. Different years, but June 26th is me and Schwartzman's. We're summer boys, you see. We're summer babies.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, amazing. The perfect guest.
Every time it comes up, I always remember, because every time June 26th comes along, you do that thing where you go on IMDb or whatever and see whose birthday it is. It's always Schwartzman, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Aubrey Plaza, I think. So I've got two of the guys in this.
Amazing. I think the notable ones for me are William Shatner and the late great Stephen Sondheim were like two of the ones that, like, I was like, oh, that's a dinner party.
That's nice.
Last time, I think your answer to this next question was very topical. So let's see if it's changed. You want to go a bit more heartfelt, or you just want to crack another joke? It's the most important question on the pod, Matt. Mm-hmm. What does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Release the Batgirl cut. None more topical.
Perfect, Matt. Well, on that note, where can people find you? Obviously, you're across a lot of places, but what places are you across, and where can we find you on those places?
Yeah, come to me on Twitter, Matt @MattBrothers2. That's kind of the central hub for all things me. And then pod-wise, yes, I'm across Spotlight, @SpotlightPod on Twitter, with my boys Liam and Paul. We cover all things Star Trek from a non-Trekkie perspective. I'm with Daryl and Jeanette over on Sudden Double Deep, where we watch three films linked by a word in the title. And of course, I'm over at Is Paul Dano OK?, which, as mentioned, is briefly transforming into Greer's for this new season, hopefully starting sometime in September, for another run of eight or so films with a Judy Greer focus before we decamp and pray that The Fabelmans gets a timely UK release.
lovely. Yeah. Let's hope it gets a. Let's hope it gets a. I think, like, your fingers crossed for that getting a London Film Festival premiere. I'm really fingers crossed for Butcher's Crossing, the new Nicolas Cage film.
Is that the one where the Hollywood Reporter roundtables, where he was telling that great story about a horse?
Yeah, Jonathan Majors knew the horse.
Yes, and he's like, that horse was an asshole to me, man.
Yeah, Jonathan Majors was like, kind of like, must be some kind of horse whisperer. Was like, oh yeah, me and that horse go back years. Like, okay, John, like, slow your roll a bit, mate.
So that's that film, is it? What's it called?
Butcher's Crossing.
Oh, man.
I'm currently just about to dive into the book. Apparently it's a really, like, renowned book by John Williams. So a little book recommendation for people as well before watching that film. So, Matt, thanks once again for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you so much for having me, man. It's been amazing.
And there we go, ladies and gentlemen. Episode 48 is in the biggie bank. Thank you once again to Matt Brothers for coming and joining me. And thank you so much for you guys for listening. And if you're not across all of the podcasts that Matt is on, then what the hell are you doing? Both Sudden Double Deep, Spotlight, and Is Paul Dano OK? are kind of always in my regular rotation of podcasts I listen to. Day of release, I'm always there. They're lots of fun. And Matt is, as you've just heard, is a fountain of knowledge when it comes to films. It was a joy to have him on for this one, seeing as he has such a wealth of knowledge in regards to the kind of Scott Pilgrim universe, as it were, throughout all mediums. So, yeah, what an absolute banger of a guest. It's always great when people have this expert knowledge, and that's kind of what I strive for here on this old here podcast, is people are passionate about the films we're talking about. Sometimes I might not necessarily be, but sometimes their passion brings out my passion for the film. I kind of look at it through their eyes, and it's kind of interesting. I don't know, I try not to be negative about stuff on this podcast, but then sometimes you gotta be, right? If something's bad, you gotta say they're bad. So this one was a lot of fun. I'm sure you've probably voiced your opinion about Scott Pilgrim versus the World on socials if you have an opinion about this film. But let us know what you thought about our chat. Did we miss anything? Is there a point about the film that you really enjoy that we happen to miss? Did we say anything that kind of enlightened you on anything? Or have you watched the behind-the-scenes documentary just like I have as well? And you're kind of listening to this going, yeah. We get it. We've all watched that. But if you do want to get in touch, as I said up front on this episode, please do so at Caged In Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and TikTok. Or you can drop me an email, which is always lovely and nice, and that is cagedinpod@gmail.com. I haven't really had any emails for a while. Send an email. Send an email for film that you want to see coming up in the future. Obviously, there's look through the back catalogue. What's missing? What would you like to hear an episode on? I'm probably sure I've got a guest lined up for it. I've got about 30 something guests lined up for episodes. I just need the time to get through them all. That's it. I've made a hard line rule for myself that I will not be taking on any new guests until I have got through this list. So yeah, expect the next 30 something episodes to be guests that I already have lined up. That matters as well. So next week on the podcast, let's talk about next week. I will be talking to Alex Glinston all about the 2009 Wes Anderson stop motion animated Roald Dahl adaptation, The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which Jason Schwartzman plays Ash, the Fantastic Mr. Fox's son, in a great voice turn in that film. So I look forward to having that conversation, which I haven't had yet, time of record, but I'm sure it'll be fun because I absolutely adore that film. And I'm sure you'll enjoy that conversation when it is upon your ears. So if you've enjoyed this episode or any other episode of the podcast, please don't hesitate to head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and leave a 5-star rating and review. But remember to, in your review, let me know what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. Or for Schwartzman Summer, let me know, what's your favourite Jason Schwartzman film? I would love to know. And if that's not enough for you, if you really want to support the podcast, you want to part with some money, you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where for as little as £1 a month, $1 a month, you can support this podcast, just chucking a bit of money in the hat, or a little bit more, £2.50. You can get access to our series where we're looking at every single film directed by the one, the only Brian De Palma in the movie Brat Bros tier, which is a lot of fun. It's kind of been on the back burner at the moment, but I vow to get that back up and running in no time. Promises, but it will happen. I promise you. So, as always, guys, I have been Petros Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world, the Coppola family tree. Remember to come join us next week. We'll be getting fantastic. We'll be getting foxy. We'll be digging warrens. We'll be getting up to hijinks. We'll be stealing chickens and all other types of fun as we make another Coppola connection.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.